giving you guys a few minutes to set up, but just a reminder, you will each get 15 minutes for your argument, and appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. If you weren't here during the previous introduction, we would ask that you please use the middle podium because that's where the recording is occurring. And also, if you would please make sure that you identify yourself for the record and the party that you're representing. There's only an audio record that's being created of these proceedings, and so if you would make sure that we have a good audio record, we would appreciate that. With that, Mr. Warner, are you ready to begin?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court, opposing counsel, my name is George Warner and I represent the appellant in these proceedings, Lariat Companies, Inc. This is a rather unique and twisted case, at least in my experience, just given its longevity. It has been going on since 2010, or fully one-third of my legal career of 30 years, so I think it's notable in that regard significantly. Just briefly, I'd like to talk about the facts for a moment, because they are so complex and so convoluted, I think it's important to put things in context this morning. This case began in 2010 as a lease case involving a Mexican fast food restaurant near the Eden Prairie Mall. It's been going on ever since then. The 2010 litigation over the breached lease eventually resulted in a money judgment against Mr. Michael Wigley and his company due to the restaurant's failure. That in turn led to a 2011 state court fraud case because while Lariat was pursuing Mr. Wigley with collection actions, he decided that he would provide nearly $1 million worth of his assets to his spouse, Miss Barbara Wigley, to try to hide them and shield them from the claims of his creditors. That case also began unfolding. In 2013, there was a fraud trial before Judge Rosenbaum. That resulted in a second money judgment, and that was an $800,000 money judgment, roughly, against Mr. Wigley and Ms. Wigley jointly and severally. That's a second judgment that was in addition to the first judgment from the lease case that was roughly $2.3 million.
Well, Mr. Warner, would you agree that the many courts that have already addressed the issues in this case have determined that the two judgments were duplicative? In other words, that they involved some of the same funds?
Yes, I would. This case, in some form or another, or some variant of this case, because I think there's a total of six pieces of litigation, has been in every court in this state, in every court in this nation, except the Minnesota Supreme Court and the United States Supreme Court. And I believe that at least in two or three instances, there's been written opinions that describe how the two judgments, although distinct, are interrelated and duplicative of one another. And some of the complexity with the issue here today is the interplay between those two judgments, obviously derived from a similar or related series of transactions, but yet also somewhat distinct or different. And that's because, of course, the fraud judgment bears all the characteristics of being derived from the fraudulent transfer from Michael Wigley to Barbara Wigley. In other words, had there not been that fraudulent transfer of nearly $1 million, the original $2.4 million judgment would have ended the matter. We would never be pursuing Ms. Wigley, and Ms. Wigley would have no liability in any of these pieces of litigation. Her liability springs into existence or derives from the fact that, and Judge Fisher found in some very detailed findings in the federal adversary bankruptcy trial, that she was an active participant in this fraudulent scheme where she received the $800,000.
So if the two judgments are duplicative, then why wouldn't Mr. Wigley's payment be credited against the judgment in the fraud case? That's where you kind of lose me in your argument.
Absolutely. So there's two essential points that I'll make today substantively, and I want to make sure I address that question. One, that argument was made already, and it was rejected by the court, by Judge McGill, and by this court, the Court of Appeals, when it fixed the amount of Ms. Barbara Wigley's liability. So her argument that Mr. Wigley's payment in his Chapter 11 bankruptcy should be applied to reduce her fraudulent transfer liability, we maintain that collateral estoppel bars that argument from being brought again before Judge Moore. And that Judge Moore's...
Based on my read of the 2020 decision of this court, however, the court, the decision in conjunction with the attempts to supplement the addendum in the case, looking at those two things together, it appears to me that this court concluded that the matter of crediting the payments was not before us in 2020 and had, was not relevant to the issues that we were considering then.
That, I think, then raises the point, Your Honor, that it could have been brought before the court. Can a party who had the opportunity available to them to make an argument and all the facts before them to make the argument, namely, apply this payment to reduce my liability, but chooses not to bring that before this court, can they lie in wait, let other proceedings unfold, and then bring a second appeal on the same facts that existed before that they chose not to pursue and bring it before the court now later, making the argument they could have made earlier? Can you reserve your right?
Aren't the factual circumstances a little different now, though, because at this juncture, payment has been made, whereas, back in 2020, the issue wasn't really ripe for Ms. Wigley to bring.
I think that point is incorrect, and I'll explain. The question is, how narrow do you define the issue that you're going to bring before the court, or how narrow do you define the question to be resolved? Is it the application of Ms. Wigley's payment to fully satisfy the judgment? Is it the question of how do we take this payment into account when this payment might eliminate all judgment liability, full satisfaction? Or is the question, how do we apply the payment? Mr. Wigley's payment had been made at the time of the prior appeal, so it certainly could have been addressed, and its implications to Ms. Wigley could have been ruled upon. The judgment wasn't fully satisfied at that point, and so that's a different issue. That's a more narrow issue. I think that the defendant, the respondents, unfortunately, failed to bring that before the court when they had an opportunity to bring it before the court, and that should bar them at this juncture. In other words, they're reframing the issue or making it a different issue and then choosing to bring that issue before the court. And Lariat just fundamentally disagrees. We believe it's the same issue. And it existed back then. Mr. Wigley had made his payment. You knew about that. And to borrow the analogy from our brief, you even argued about it. You argued that point to try to reduce your liability to zero and go for the home run instead of just trying to, get on base by saying reduce her liability. So if you frame the issue that narrowly, then yes, you could make the argument it's a different issue, but we just respectfully disagree. We think it's the same issue, it's the same facts, and they should be barred from raising it now at this point before this court. The second point that I'll make in my time remaining is that procedurally, even if they were allowed to make this argument, and I don't want to give that up, I don't think they should be, the trial court still erred when it applied the payment to reduce her liability to zero. And that gets back to this complex interplay between the two judgments. And the best analogy I've come up with to try to bring some life to these rather dry concepts of the judgment amounts are the tree. The larger landlord-tenant judgment is a tall tree. It's $2.4 million. And as payments are made, that cuts the tree down towards its base. But this fraudulent transfer judgment that both Michael Wigley and Barbara Wigley are liable for, that's the base or trunk of the tree. And these payments never get down to the trunk. It's an, I think, important point to recognize that Mr. Wigley's federal bankruptcy discharge does not extinguish his debt to Lariat. The full amount of the judgment, less what he's paid, is still owed to Lariat. Now, we'll never collect that. The federal statutes prohibit it, but the debt's not extinguished.
Given the conclusion of previous courts that the debt is duplicative, to go along with your tree analogy, isn't the $2.2 million judgment actually the base of the tree, and the fraud is the sort of trunk above that base? I mean, isn't that $2.2 million the foundation of all of the debt in this case, all of the money owed?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. If you use that argument and to follow it to its logical conclusion, then these payments might well have eliminated or satisfied in full Ms. Wigley's liability. But I think that's an incorrect way of viewing this. And that's because, and I think now you've got to get back to understanding Mr. Wigley's Chapter 11 case. In his Chapter 11 case, the federal courts would not permit a claim for the fraudulent transfer judgment because it was duplicative. It was not permitted. And the amount that Lariat received from Michael Wigley's bankruptcy case, capped by the bankruptcy code, was a greatly reduced amount paid towards his lease obligation, but not the fraudulent transfer obligation, because that would in turn be duplicative. And so it doesn't apply to, and it shouldn't reduce, Barbara Wigley's liability for that fraudulent transfer judgment. And that's why we think the trial court erred when they applied that payment towards the fraudulent transfer judgment, towards Barbara Wigley's liability. It should not have been applied in that fashion. Those are my essential points, Your Honor. One, the argument's procedurally barred. It's been raised before this court, we believe, depending on how you define the issue, and the respondent should not be allowed to trot it out again before this court. And then secondly,
can I ask one clarifying question on that? Are you arguing that it's collateral estoppel that bars this claim? Are you arguing that it's claim preclusion, or are you arguing that it's both?
It's issue preclusion. I think that, in fact, Judge Moore got it correct when he defined it and analyzed it in the lens of collateral estoppel, but down through to issue preclusion. It's just in his analysis of the elements of that, he erred in defining the issue.
So you agree that this isn't a new claim, that this is one of the, you're claiming that this is an issue in an existing litigation as opposed to that this would be a new claim of some kind?
This claim has been brought many times before. This claim is, how do we apply Michael Wigley's payment, and what is the impact of Michael Wigley's payment on this litigation as a whole and in connection with Barbara Wigley's liability? And so, yes, we think it's issue preclusion.
Thank you,
and if it's not issue preclusion, the trial court still incorrectly applied the payment, which, again, we've just kind of explained throughout. So if there's any further questions, I'd be glad to address them. If not, I'll remain for my rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Ms. Marks.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I am Heather Marks, a partner with the firm of Cozen O'Connor, and I represent respondent Barbara Wigley. My client and I appreciate your consideration and respectfully request a prompt affirmance of the trial court's order in this matter. Appellant made a very strategic litigation decision in 2012 when it decided, in the course of its fraudulent transfer action against respondent, they specifically requested that Michael Wigley be joined as a defendant in that action. And that motion from appellant was opposed by my client, it was opposed by Mr. Wigley, and it was granted. and it was affirmed by this court on appeal. That is a joint and several judgment, and Mr. Wigley was on the verdict form. And now, nearly 9 years later, appellant wants to overlook the very real consequence of this strategic decision and ignore the plain fact that joint and several means joint and several. The trial court understood that, and regardless of what combination of payments are received from those joint and several debtors, they need to be applied toward the debt. In 2021, with the third of the payments that were made by the Wigleys, one by Mr. Wigley, two by Mrs. Wigley, appellant has now received more than $1.1 million on a $788,000 judgment. That judgment has been paid. It's satisfied in full. The decade-long saga, I like to find points where we can agree, Mr. Warner. A decade-long saga is done. Respondent and her husband have satisfied the fraudulent transfer judgment. Judge Moore was very thorough in his 2021 order. It was correct under Minnesota law, and it should be affirmed. The two main arguments that appellant advances are that respondent should not be allowed credit for the payments that her joint and several debtor made on the judgment at issue, and she should be precluded by the doctrine of collateral estoppel from the trial court even considering in 2021 the issue of application of the payments. Both of those arguments fail, and the trial court was correct in its review of these issues. I want to turn first to this issue of the credit, because at its heart, appellant's main argument is that respondent should not receive any credit, not one penny of credit, towards satisfaction of the judgment from the $637,581 that her joint and several co-debtor paid, because that amount needs to be credited under appellant's argument. Are you okay, Your Honor?
I am. Okay. I apologize.
No, that's okay. Appellant argues that needs to be credited against a larger debt stemming from the original rent guarantee. That judgment was issued against Mr. Wigley in 2011. Here's what appellant misses in that argument: that the initial judgment obtained against Mr. Wigley is the discharge destroys appellant's remedy to collect anything further. The Eighth Circuit, are you sure you're okay, Your Honor? Okay. The Eighth Circuit was very clear in its analysis here when it overruled the bankruptcy appellate panel that the discharge Mr. Wigley achieved destroys any ability appellant has to collect anything further from him. So there is no tall tree. If anything, Your Honor, you're exactly right that rent judgment is the base from which the fraudulent transfer stemmed. An appellant cannot collect anything more from Mr. Wigley than the $637,000 it's been paid to satisfy its claim.
So just a question on this point. Would you agree that the discharge amount that Mr. Wigley paid went to the 2.2 lease judgment as opposed to the fraud judgment?
It went to both, Your Honor. And this is where it's very important to understand. In bankruptcy, the proof of claim that Lariat submitted, that appellant submitted, had both judgments on it. It had the rent judgment and it had the fraudulent transfer judgment on it. Those were both in its proof of claim. It had one proof of claim. That proof of claim is what the bankruptcy court evaluated. Many different bankruptcy courts evaluated. And we have holdings here from the bankruptcy appellate panel, from the Eighth Circuit, that are in agreement that these, and in order for this court to find to the contrary and hold that Judge Moore in his 2021 order was erroneous and buy into appellant's argument, we really have to dispatch the holdings, particularly of the Eighth Circuit, where they say the fraudulent transfer judgment related to collection of lease claims is capped by the 502b6 claim. They're one and the same. Everything is capped. Through the bankruptcy process, there's one claim, and they were paid on that one claim, and that one claim extinguished their rights to collect from Mr. Wigley anything further on both the rent judgment and the fraudulent transfer judgment. They've been paid by him. The sophisticated bankruptcy analysis is very clear that there is one. They're not separate anymore. So because that entire amount that Mr. Wigley owed to appellant through the bankruptcy court proceedings, because that was satisfied, we made a motion in 2016 to say they're paid in full. They submitted one proof of claim that covered two judgments. That should excuse Mrs. Wigley from any further payment. And that was an argument as a matter of law. There was no facts that were a part of that. It had nothing to do with the actual payment, the amount of the payment. That was completely peripheral. The issue raised in 2016 was very different than the issue that we raised in 2021. Issue in 2016 is, as a matter of law, is the judgment against Mrs. Wigley extinguished? And the courts told us it's not. So then we go back and we have to look at the course of payments that were made in order to determine when is that $788,000 fraudulent transfer judgment satisfied. Not extinguished, but satisfied. And so what we have said is, well, you got a $637,000 payment from Mr. Wigley in August of 2016. And this is where I always worry about myself when I take a detour from my notes, but this is, you know, your point earlier to Mr. Warner about the issue in 2016. We made that motion, the Rule 60 motion, in July of 2016. At that point in time, zero payments had been made. None. Mr. Wigley had a confirmed plan, but he had not made any payments. There is no Rule 11 basis that we could have extended in July of 2016 when we made that motion to say that the judgment is satisfied as a matter of fact through payments, because no payments had been made. And in fact, those payments weren't made until August of 2016. And then the payments from Mrs. Wigley through the course of her bankruptcy, and then so she paid hers in March of 2020 and in July of 2022. So she made her payments years after the fact, after the Rule 60 motion that was brought in 2016. So the collateral estoppel issue that appellant comes back to was also properly denied by the trial court. The issues have to be identical in order for collateral estoppel to apply. Here, a number of courts have looked at it. You're exactly right that this court, when it looked at the prior appeal, found that this issue was outside the scope of what it was ruling on. No court has ruled on it. This issue has not been raised. It had not been briefed. It had not been brought to any court for examination prior to our motion in 2021 after all the payments have been made. So that's the first time it was there. There is no prior determination, and we didn't have a full and fair opportunity to address this issue in 2016. I'm very glad that you brought up the supplemental additions in 2016 that were made, because if you look at the motion that was actually made, the Rule 60 motion that was made in 2016, and this is on the addendum at page 28, Barbara Wigley argues in her motion to vacate that it is inequitable to enforce the order's judgment against her because of Ms. Michael Wigley's bankruptcy discharge and because she believes Michael Wigley was not insolvent. That was the issue that was raised in 2016. It is very distinct from the issue that was raised in 2021, which could not have been brought further. Judge Moore understood this distinction, and he raised that in his findings. And he was correct that the issues here were not identical. There's at least one other element where appellant doesn't carry its burden in order to prove that collateral estoppel exists. And again, that's the full and fair opportunity. Appellant was the one who tried to expand the scope of the 2016 motion. And the addendum at page 14 demonstrates how Mrs. Wigley's counsel at that time responded to it and said, listen, that's an open issue. That's not before this court. If you want more briefing, we can talk about that, but that's not our motion. That's not an issue here. And so there was no full and fair opportunity to raise that. And it's, like I said before, Rule 11 would have precluded her from precluded respondent from raising it at that point in time. So without argument, without briefing, without facts, without any court's prior consideration, there's no way for appellant to carry its burden to establish that before 2021, there was a full and fair opportunity to be heard on this. Collateral estoppel is not a game of gotcha. It's not a game at all. Have you had the opportunity to have this claim vetted, discussed, and decided? This claim was not vetted, discussed, and decided, nor could it have been until 2021 when it was decided by Judge Moore. And the one other thing that I think is important for us to discuss, and this goes back a bit to the issue of crediting, what Judge Moore also got exactly right in his order was the analysis of two statutes which are central to this court, to his analysis and to this court's analysis. And that's statute 513.48 and statute 548.19. We didn't hear appellant talk about those because there's no way to argue around the fact that both of these statutes mandate the exact conclusion that Judge Moore came to. Turn first to Section 51348, and that statute's clear as to the total amount that a creditor can collect from a transferee. And we have to completely ignore this statute and its plain language in order to grant appellant's appeal here. The amount that a creditor can collect from a transferee is limited to the amount necessary to satisfy the creditor's claim or the value of the asset transferred, whichever is less. And in this case, it's very clear whichever is less is the $788,000 fraudulent transfer judgment. That's the total amount that appellant can collect from Mrs. Wegley. And there's no disputing that they've now collected that amount. So that works in connection with the next statute, and that's statute 54819. That's the joint and several statute. There's no dispute here that this is a joint and several fraudulent transfer judgment, which is the total amount they can collect from Mrs. Wegley. By their design, this is joint and several. And in order to analyze this, the trial court was astute and said that payment under the statute, payment against the judgment by any co-tortfeasor is credited toward all co-tortfeasors. Easy for me to say. That's page 8 of Judge Moore's order. That's what the statute mandates. Here we have one joint and several co-tortfeasor who has paid $637,000 on a joint and several judgment. That amount needs to be credited, and Judge Moore understood that and made that proper crediting. They included this judgment against him as part of their proof of claim. It's there. They've been paid on it. The rest of it, yes, the debt remains, but their remedy, their ability to collect on it is destroyed. The Eighth Circuit made that clear. So they've collected, more than $1.1 million from the Wegleys on a $788,000 judgment. That judgment satisfied and paid in full, and we can be done with this case after many, many years, unless the court has further questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Warner, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to address the proof of claim concept because it's a complex one, and the interplay it goes back to the interplay between the federal bankruptcy proceedings and the state court proceedings and how they're similar yet different. In connection with both Michael Wegley and Barbara Wegley's bankruptcies, Lariat as a creditor was allowed to put a claim in connection with the bankruptcy and try to recover a portion of the amounts owed from Michael Wegley and Barbara Wegley. And that process is governed by the federal bankruptcy code and by the federal bankruptcy courts. And the whole reason why Michael Wegley and Barbara Wegley took bankruptcy was because under 502b6 of Chapter 11, there's a very specific federal statute that says if it's a landlord who's coming after you with a really big judgment, we will cap the amount the landlord can recover. And there's a great kind of public policy behind it, and that's because most small businesses fail. Most small businesses owe a lot of creditors a lot of money, and normally the largest creditor owed the most is the landlord. And if you let the landlord get paid everything it was owed, there'd be absolutely nothing else for anyone else.
Mr. Warner, do you agree with Ms. Marks, however, that the proof of claim had both judgments on it?
I do not in the least, Your Honor, and here's why. If you look at and you study the federal proceedings in this case, you'll see that Lariat had a proof of claim that originally was, I believe, in the $1.1 million range, and it did include the fraudulent transfer judgment, and that was not allowed. It was not allowed by the bankruptcy courts. The amount that was permitted by Lariat to recover from Michael Wegley was roughly the principal amount of $300,000. It lasted so long with interest and the rest ended up being about $600,000, and when it was finally paid, but that payment did not include the fraudulent transfer judgment. And when you look at the bankruptcy appellate decision, perhaps the Eighth Circuit as well, the language there is we will not permit Lariat to recover its fraudulent transfer judgment in connection with the bankruptcy because it's duplicative. So it's kind of this, you know, I want my cake and I want to eat it too. I didn't have to pay Lariat anything in the fraudulent transfer amount in connection with my bankruptcy because the claim was only the lease claim, not the fraudulent transfer claim. It was considered duplicative. And that's law of the case. But now here in Barbara's case, I want to take my plan payment that was not anything to do with the fraudulent transfer judgment and say, well, in over here in Barbara's case, we're going to apply it to the fraudulent transfer judgment. Well, it doesn't work. It's kind of one or the other. And that's why it's significant to examine the federal proceedings and how the proof of claim that Michael Wigley ended up paying, the allowed claim after the litigation in his case, does not include that fraudulent transfer component. The federal courts would not permit it. There's also another, I think, important distinction with the Barbara Wigley liability, and that's Mr. Wigley received a discharge in connection with his Chapter 7. So all of his obligations can never be collected. They're forever barred by operation of the federal bankruptcy code. In Barbara Wigley's Chapter 11, we had a second adversary trial before Judge Fisher here in St. Paul. And the purpose of that trial was to get a determination that her additional liability, beyond that which the bankruptcy code would permit, this additional fraud liability would never go away. It would forever be non-dischargeable. And there was a second trial, a multi-day trial, before Judge Fisher where he held, yes, that is a non-dischargeable debt. It was procured or obtained through fraud, so it will not be eliminated by the bankruptcy discharge. And that's what we're continuing to collect today. So the character or nature of that judgment liability that exists against Barbara Wigley is fundamentally different than the payments received in Michael Wigley's case. And that's why there's another important consideration as to the application of Michael's payment against her liability just being fundamentally wrong or incorrect. And that's my final point, Your Honor, unless the court has any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank both counsel for your arguments today. This case has been submitted, and we will issue an opinion within the statutory time frame.